From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Many anti-imperialists rightly condemn the U.S., but say nothing about the crimes committed by President Bashar al-Assad, a dictator accused of monstrous war crimes who is being given tacit support by major organizations in the peace movement. So begins an article at the website In These Times by Terry Burke, who describes herself as a longtime peace activist, now working with a group called the Committee in Solidarity with the People of Syria. That group blames the Syrian government and Russia for the misery facing the people of that country. The article continues, the March 13th United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC, anti-war protest in New York City included people carrying the flag of the brutal Assad regime, some even wearing T-shirts with Assad's image. The pro-Assad Syrian American Forum officially supported this march, along with Veterans for Peace, the Manhattan Green Party, David Swanson of WarIsACrime.org, and other left-wing organizations and peace activists. We discussed this article and some of the questions it raises, including whether or not a proxy war is being fought against the anti-war movement by the Clinton campaign, with Margaret Kimberly, columnist at BlackAgendaReport.com with a weekly column, Freedom Rider. We spoke with her via Skype from New York City Thursday. Margaret, a pleasure to speak with you as always.
Oh, thank you, Don.
So, out there in the blogosphere, people that identify as being leftists and or progressives have a diversity of opinion over which side to support, or in any event, which side to struggle against in the Syrian war. You want to talk about some of that?
Yeah, this has been Syria has been an issue of divergent opinion and debate among leftists, how to respond to what started as a some protest against the Assad government, which was seized upon by the United States and Turkey and Israel and Saudi Arabia and Qatar. I don't know who else I'm leaving out, to overthrow Assad. This began in 2011, the same year that Libya was destroyed, and it was seen by those forces as an opportunity to do what they, to pick off another secular Arab government. So it's turned into, it's called a civil war, but it is an attack on Syria by all the countries I just mentioned, or by their proxies. It involves al-Nusra. They've just changed their name. I can't remember what their... It's the al-Qaeda branch in Syria.
Right.
Although apparently they pay attention to PR, so recently changed their name.
Yeah.
We got to
check the trade. We
got to
check the we got to check the trademark office to see if they filed for the new name yet.
Yes. Yes. So Daesh, ISIS, ISIL, which thrives everywhere where the U.S. has intervened. By the way. In this attempt to get rid of Assad, and his attempt to defend his country has been a five-year-long humanitarian disaster of 9 million people displaced. The UN estimate is 400,000 people dead, all because of imperialism, in short. But it's not, the reaction is not simple. There are people who emphasize more being opposed to intervention. There are those who oppose intervention, but they're squeamish about saying anything about supporting Assad himself. There are people who are who believe in condemning everybody. So when Russia, after years of verbal support for Assad, finally stepped in at the invitation of Syria and assisted in their bombing campaign almost a year ago, there were people who were happy. I was. There were people who said, no, Putin's not a nice guy. This is a bad thing. This is going to make things worse. So there are people like myself. I'm not concerned with condemning Assad or Putin. I take a very strict view about intervention and the need for there to be resistance to U.S. Interventions around the world. So this has created ongoing splits among people who call themselves left, who may agree otherwise on other issues. Recently, UNEC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, of which I am a member of the administrative committee, responded to an article in These Times by a woman named Terry Burke, who criticized us and others for, she said, not listening to Syrian voices. Now, it was somewhat contradictory, because part of her critique showed a photograph from a rally. We had a rally on 34th Street and Herald Square in March, a few months ago. I was among the many speakers. And there was a photograph of Syrians who had Syrian flags. Some of them had Assad's image on them. And we were taken to task for somehow promoting Assad. Now, it was very contradictory. On the one hand, it was, you don't listen to Syrians enough, and definitely there were Syrians there who showed up showing support for Assad. Mm-hmm. But I guess they were the wrong kind of Syrians.
Right.
At any rate, I mean, there's another number of issues here. I would not write anything criticizing her organization, but there are people like that who, there are people who do things like that. So, UNAC, our administrative committee, we strove mightily to, I don't know if you've ever written anything by committee, it's not a pretty sight, but we did, It took almost a week, but we wrote a response that everyone could agree on to Terry Burke, and it's you can see it online on UNAC's website, which is unacpeace.org, and you can read the original article and our response. Now, I think there are a couple of things that are, have caused people like this Terry Burke to emerge. I think it's a result of the presidential election and the doubling down by Hillary Clinton, making clear she's going to be try to be even more imperialist than Obama is, and the ratcheting up of rhetoric against Russia, and Russia is now being blamed for everything except bad weather. In the United States, her way of deflecting attention from the contents of the DNC emails that were leaked is to say, well, Russia was behind it. And the whole corporate media and the Democratic Party and everybody chimes in and says Russia was behind it.
Yeah.
Because the contents themselves are so damaging and they don't want to discuss that.
Right.
Her problem with keeping this private email server while she was Secretary of State, and the only possible reason to do that is if you're hiding something. And she was hiding her continued activity with the Clinton Foundation, so-called foundation, as she was Secretary of State, and commingling her interests as Secretary of State with this international influence peddling slush fund that she and her husband ran. So there are all these little minefields for her for the next 8 weeks between now and Election Day, 8 or 9 weeks, I think. So I think that's another reason the rhetoric is ratcheted up. And I think people on the left, putatively on the left, are still very much tied to the Democratic Party. And I think they feel uncomfortable in enunciating a policy that so clearly diverges from what the Democrats are up to. And that's one of my theories. But I also think that there are people on the left who, maybe I shouldn't say somebody, if someone calls himself a leftist, maybe I shouldn't say that they aren't. But I don't think they are.
Right.
And they're the fact that they're so squeamish about Assad and so afraid of being called pro-Assad to me shows their political lack of development, that they don't emphasize that all this suffering has been created by Obama, with Hillary, starting with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, and the suffering, if they're concerned about the suffering of people in Syria, the condemnation has to be directed at this country.
Yeah, at the source.
Yes.
I mean, we'll go back to the history that you touched on at the beginning. In 2011, you had situation that developed in Egypt and the situation that developed in Tunisia and then the situation that developed in Libya and the situation that developed in Syria all at the same time. And they seemed to be coordinated essentially from Washington with the Saudis, Turks, Qataris, etc. And then you had the situation that developed in Bahrain also, and all of this was characterized under the umbrella of Arab Spring, as if it were some indigenous and, a movement of whole cloth across the board. And very different responses, of course. Well, actually, the response was pretty much the same, occupation in one way or another, or attempted occupation, or just outright destruction of the country by one force or another allied with the U.S. and or Saudi Arabia and or Turkey and or Qatar. So, and it was pretty obvious that what was happening was a regime change project across that region, and that the United States had a heavy hand in it, including bombing Libya back to the Stone Age, practically literally, and leaving like 9 million people displaced in Syria, and however many hundreds of thousands, if it's not a million people dead. To me, that seems like an easy thing to parse. And then you have, as part of this history also, a number of elections. First, a constitution referendum that was passed overwhelmingly by an overwhelming majority of Syrians living on planet Earth, including people that are not living inside Syria, but Syrians. And you had Assad elected president twice by wide margins, absolute majorities of, again, Syrians all over the world. The election of a parliament, again, with vast majorities given to the present government, including opposition parties. And yet, the legitimacy of that government is not recognized in the eyes of the people who are lining up to enable what they are perceiving of or selling as humanitarian intervention against the dictator.
Yeah, and I think there's another problem here, that it's a bigger problem than just the facts of the case, and that is the way Americans perceive themselves and perceive the world, and what many people who call themselves leftists, what they really want. There is this underlying belief that people in other parts of the world, particularly if they're not white, if they're brown-skinned people, such as in the Middle East and North Africa, that they don't know what's good for them. And people in the United States know better.
Right.
And there's this, it's still the white man's burden, it's manifest destiny, it's this belief in U.S. goodness. And so even people on the left still want to be part of that, and I think that's why there's this reflexive, well, Assad is bad too, so I can't say anything about Assad. Now, the reality is, I don't know how many people really know much about Assad. I certainly can't claim to have become a Syrian expert since 2011, but I think this knee-jerk reaction is partly what you're talking about, and Americans don't like to think of themselves as being bad, and so they don't want to, if they know much about it at all, they don't want to talk about regime change, they don't want to talk about the hand that the United States has around the world in destabilizing governments, in overthrowing elected people, all of the things that we're told are the reasons for U.S. foreign policy decisions are generally lies. And so you have these people who like to think of themselves as being in opposition to the system when they're really not. And there's a step beyond which they cannot go. So they will respond to, you know, images of refugees or children being killed. They can respond to that, but that's as far as they can go. They can't think outside of this box of American, I know to say, white American superiority, and they can't think outside the box of self-determination of people. They don't believe in that. They don't know anything about Syria, but reflexively, their government keeps saying Assad is a butcher, Assad is a dictator, he's a butcher, he's a killer, he's a this, he's a that. And they're afraid to counter that argument, or even to say, well, that could be true, but the United States doesn't have a right to destroy his country, so who's the dictator, who's the tyrant? If the 9 million people had homes and had a decent country and had a civil society, how can you not defend trying to protect that and just say, well, Assad's a bad guy, so he should leave because the United States says he should leave? So I think all of these things are at play and create problems, especially in an election year, with this continued deadly allegiance to the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, you know, the phenomenon that you're describing can be summed up white supremacy at home, imperialism abroad, and exchanged too. White supremacy abroad and imperialism at home. It's like Malcolm X spoke, for example, and others of the African people in the United States being colonized, an internal colony, and so you know, the terms can be interchanged, but they're more or less. White supremacy being, I guess, the ideology of imperialism, the dominant ideology.
Yes, it is. It is. And, you know, it's an ideology which it hinges on a belief in American superiority. So no other agenda is legitimate. So other countries have to be demonized. And in this case, Russia is demonized. And I was about to, I'm going to have to respond to someone on Facebook who differs with me about Syria, but he always says the same thing. Putin's not a nice guy. Now, I've never said Putin is a nice guy.
Right.
When you talk about world leaders, you're not talking about nice people. Right. You know,
I don't even understand how that's part of the, that's not even part of the calculus. You're looking at policies and their actions as state actors or whatever, you know?
Yes. So, you know, Putin's not a nice guy. And I, you know, never say Putin is a nice guy. But that's the level of analysis that people have. It's about good and bad. And that he continually brings this up as if people who are opposed to U.S. interventions are saying Assad and Putin and whomever else are good people. We haven't said that.
Right.
And we're not trying to judge. So, and in this sense, about what should happen with the fate of Syria, whether any of these, you know, not nice people are in fact nice, but so this is also part of the problem too. It's a very immature, one-dimensional point of view about the world that hinges on some pretty retrograde, beliefs in. Pretty much the white man's burden. It's still, it all,
right.
In the end, that's what it all boils down
that's
to,
right.
I think.
Yeah. You know, okay, so you have this level of conversation going on, which is essentially obfuscation. It takes the place in the public sphere of a discussion of facts and policy, as it's clearly intended to do. And it has all the spin-offs of people, you know, just the constituencies out in the world getting preoccupied with this crap at the water cooler or whatever, instead of talking about policy and looking at the facts. And among the facts, I'm waiting for the emails that detail the State Department, Hillary Clinton, and whomever else the conversations were with, including perhaps the president, the beginning of the Syrian war, the U.S. involvement in it, the direction of policy, all of the things that key to the initial events that ended up catalyzing into this war. That is information I would love to see out there, and I'm sure somebody has it, and yet we're talking about who's a nice guy.
Yeah, I think so. And I, well, you know, and the other reason this has become an issue is as we get closer to Election Day, WikiLeaks have said they have more documents and they, you know, are going to release them all at strategic moments. Yeah. So nobody knows what we're going to see.
Right.
I would love to see that as well. And I would love to see a discussion in this country about U.S. foreign policy and the fact that American presidents can just decide we're going to take over this country or that country, we're going to get rid of this or that person, that Congress doesn't say anything, that the corporate media go along, that most Americans who don't know very much just say, okay, fine, if the president's of another party, they may disagree because of that, but not because of the action. But all of these things need to be discussed and are not being discussed. And there's so much propaganda, and people don't even know it as propaganda. I don't believe anything I see in the corporate media about Syria and about Russia's involvement there. I just go on the assumption that they are not being truthful, if they are, in fact, just to keep it simple, telling lies in order to cover their tracks and in order to prevent opposition to these policies that are so deadly and so dangerous to the world. So here we go again. The New York Times says that, Assad is a butcher and Putin is bad and, the leaks come straight from Moscow and whatever else, and people don't know how to seek out other information. So this also impacts our movement. So we have people who don't have the level of analysis that they should, who are not ready to say the U.S. needs to stay out of everywhere. So they react. They're fearful of being considered allied with somebody that their government has said is a bad person. So you get more and more nonsense instead of having a coherent analysis of American activity abroad. But I think, and it's important, I think, that UNAC responded to this article in these times. Mm-hmm. But I think that shows us how important it is for us to just get our point of view out there. I think there comes a point where we can't just keep debating people. And I think other people, if they have a different point of view, they need to advocate for their point of view. And they need to have their own rally with the Syrians they think are the right Syrians to talk to. That's the other thing that, I found annoying. She kept saying that, the U.S. peace movement doesn't listen to Syrians enough. And, well, we had Syrians. But apparently they were the wrong Syrians because they walked around with images of Assad. So And I don't know why they can't be listened to, but I guess it's not the right narrative, so they're supposed to be ignored. But that just shows you what these America's history of intervention and aggressions have done and distorted so many people's thinking.
In terms of how this information would bear or the facts of the case of Syria would bear on the election if they were, openly discussed. You have, if there are people, it's a liability for Hillary Clinton when this comes out. So, theoretically, from their perspective, they risk losing votes. They risk losing votes to Trump or to Jill Stein or to Gary Johnson or to, Monica Moorhead or Gloria LaRiva or whomever. But primarily, Trump, Stein, and Johnson, Democrats who get turned off to the point they can't vote for Clinton but are going to vote would probably most likely vote for Jill Stein, independents for either Gary Johnson or Trump, and probably mostly Gary Johnson. Trump, for example, has said Syrian war is a disaster, and mm-hmm. it's we don't do regime change anymore starting day one when I'm in office. Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, essentially the same thing. So you can see the motive behind keeping this away from the public, the discussion of it, or even the facts of it, where any one of or all of these candidates could sit and read from an email or something and recite it. It's a pretty important thing, and the consequence when you have the opposition to Trump from Clinton supporters being he's an Islamophobe, among others. And here's someone who displaced 9 million primarily Muslim people, killed another 500,000 of them. We heard from the Secretary of State of her husband, who was prominent at her own DNC, but that was worth it, the killing of Iraqi children. And so, you know, it kind of takes the wind out of the sails of some of the primary attack things of Trump by the Democrats.
It should, but, you know, there's this distraction of, you know, and Trump he's done so much himself. He has been condemned by his own.
Low-hanging fruit, yeah, for sure.
Yes, he is. And the Democrats have this veneer of civility. I don't fall for it anymore, but I did for many years, where they say the right things, but it just shows you the level of discourse, the sad level of discourse that people can be so easily fooled and not even acknowledge. You don't have to support Trump in order to acknowledge he is saying no more regime change. That is what the world needs to hear from an American president. And people who claim to be on the left every time they want to get their point of view out shouldn't be supporting anyone who doesn't say the same thing. But that would mean not supporting Hillary Clinton, which creates cognitive dissonance for people who want to act as though Trump is the fascist and we don't have any fascism in this country, where Hillary Clinton is the embodiment of that. She and her boss, Barack Obama, both internationally and domestically. So we have this sad cycle that goes on and on and on. But I think it's important that we had that rally here in March. To talk about peace and the way to peace and the role the United States should be playing. Actually, the way to peace is for the United States to stop trying to play a role anyplace else in the world, for imperialism to end. That's why it's so important for us to advocate that point of view. And that's why people attack us. And if someone, you know, U.S. Peace Council recently went to Syria and they did meet with government officials, and they met with Assad. But I think that's something that can be defended. I think that people need to stop acting as though the American point of view is something to be believed, is something to not be believed. And the only way out of it is to talk to Assad. And by the way, before we go, I know time is short, but I'm reminded that a few years ago, the Russians were not always resolute in defending Syria. And a few years ago, Finnish diplomat Madiar Asari, respected man, Nobel Peace Prize winner, says that the Russians came to him and they were willing to cut Assad loose. They were willing to come up with some kind of deal to end the war, and Assad would have to leave or something. But they were willing to give Assad up. And the United States and the UK and France said, nah, he's about to fall. We don't have to make any deals. So these people who talk about the suffering of Syrians need to know that the United States continued that suffering because it's all or nothing for them. It's taking Assad out. It's putting in some jihadist that they love to do, or some plan for the U.S. to turn Syria into a puppet state. And they had an opportunity to stop the carnage, but it wasn't what they wanted. It wasn't what they wanted, so they said no. And that's going to be one of the things, one of the facts, and it is easily provable that this happened, that the United States had a chance to stop the carnage in 2012, I believe it was, and said no. And that is the story of U.S. foreign policy, and that is what people on the left need to be opposed to wherever this happens in the world.
Margaret Kimberly is an author, activist, and journalist, also a member of the Administrative Committee of the United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC. Their website is unacpeace.org. Thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.